This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, we wanted to keep some time for questions and discussion. And
it has been about an hour. So.
Yes. So we, I think the text was written a little longer. But I have one simple question to start with, and like for the people to ask. What about pain? You haven't really talked much about pain. And this was really in the title. And I was wondering whether anorexia is for you linked with pain or not at all.
Do you want to start?
No, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, as you may see, we skipped quite a lot in effort to kind of make sense and be continuous. We actually elaborated a concept of pain as pain waves. That is to say, a pain that is not appropriated or would not be appropriated necessarily by the subject itself, a pain that is, as a habit, convoluted on an impersonal level and then can be transmitted, which was one of the main theses of our chapter on masochism, can be transmitted in such a way that actually triggers the possibility of becoming impersonal. In other words, I'll put it in other words, pain in the sense we are trying to ascribe to it at this point, at least in our project, would be something quite opposite to the possibility of enjoying the pain. That is to say, it would be quite opposite to the psychoanalytic reading according to which one or there are some perverts who love their pain and enjoy it. To the contrary, we actually believe that pain is always painful and it always hurts, and as simple as that, nobody likes it. So the question then becomes why, for what reason, one would expose oneself either in micropolitics of masochism or anorexia, that is to say, non-eating or drug addiction or alcoholism, which are other forms of micropolitics that we treat. Why would anybody expose himself or herself to something that so obviously hurts and is not unpleasant? And our thesis is that that exposure is the condition of possibility of doing away with one's own identity, and that should be the point of departure for any future revolutionary micropolitics of this identification. In other words, when we use the concept of the impersonal, we don't use it as you said, Nietzsche would say, this is not a metaphor. The impersonal is not a metaphor. It is a very literal process of disidentifying oneself, and we basically believe that the disidentification of an individual, it's becoming impersonal, is the condition of possibility for various other politics, more molar politics, for example, becoming the impersonal of a nation. Do you want to?
Yeah, I just return to. Just to continue to clarify and just expand on what Branca has said, one of the fundamental things that the notion of pain waves is to do away with any economic representation of pain, pain at the limit or as a limit experience, and therefore to avoid the problem and the false and moral problem of transgression, always saying that certain exposure to pain must be understood according to a logic of transgression, which is how masochism is understood, or has been understood, not only by psychoanalysis, but in a sense, we're also working with the popular cultural notions of how these practices may be understood. In a sense that one of the beginning titles we were working was with an ontology of pain, meaning that understanding that pain is a purely impersonal being or immanence that is consequently shaped, similar to the way that Freud begins to think about how in a sense, the libido is shaped by further differentiation. But we're thinking, in a certain way, pain through pain waves, there are certain modulations which are then reduced to zero to a certain extent, but remain fundamentally painful. In our view, consciousness, normal consciousness, is fundamentally a kind of pain. But we don't become, we are no longer conscious of it as a painful effect. Certainly sexuality is painful. Certainly eating is painful, particularly when you think about the entire economy of eating in terms of the death that it involves. The pain is always inscribed in the process. But in a certain way, the subject is constructed in a way to do away with a conscious representation of their own act as pain. What we want to do away with is, in a certain way, that notion or that construction of consciousness at the center of representations of pain, in order to expose the idea of pain and of the reality of pain. We think that all representations of pain are metaphorical, meaning that there's an existential, meaning at even an existential level, a purely impersonal pain that has nothing to do with me, and that is, in a sense, even beyond horror, which I would call, in a sense, basically life.
Our concept of micropolitics is actually formed against the idea of pathological as well as the idea of perversion. In that sense, we try to introduce both the concept of masochism and the idea of anorexia or drug addiction or alcoholism as something that, if addressed in a different way, would also make visible the fact that in every classification of that sort, pathology or perversion, there is always already inscribed a certain ideology. For example, to see masochism as perversion is a very petty ideological construct that tells you that constructs a whole system of exclusion of perverts. So that anything that's basically not normal, that is to say, the whole classification is aimed at normalizing and therefore stabilizing what is non-pathological. We actually use the concept of the anomalous, following Deleuze, as something that is neither abnormal nor pathological, in order to try to address the possibility of, as we put it, abominable unions, that is to say, of any micropolitics that experiments on the borderline. And we analyze in the chapter called The Anomalous a great story related by Michel de Montaigne about an elephant in Alexandria who fell in love with a grammarian daughter and spent his life being in love with that woman, and then she fell in love with an elephant, and that was like a beautiful love story. But what we are working with is the possibility of actually crossing the border, establishing a new a union that would neither remain in the same determination, that is to say, elephant is not an elephant anymore, all other elephants hate him because he made it and he seduced the grammarian daughter, but neither he became the lawyer or the librarian or grammarian in Alexandria, which is to say that the daughter's father hates him. So they're kind of an anomalous body that resists both determinations or both molar politics. And that's always dangerous, you're right. I mean, you know, as we said in the end, anorexia is lethal, but any micropolitics is. So, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that we are aware that what we're saying can be somewhat provocative. It can be taken in different ways. It could be seen to be dangerous. I always find it interesting when, in a sense, certain discourse, is seen to be dangerous, as if all discourse consists in prescriptions. But I don't think that we're prescribing. I think that at the end we are not prescribing something except a way of analyzing the state. But let me respond. First of all, you made the statement that that we pose at the basis of our understanding of micropolitical practice is a notion of a subject who chooses, a subject who wills. Absolutely not. We never said that someone chooses something. An anorexic doesn't choose to become anorexic. They already find themselves in the middle of a process, in a sense, where anorexia is how it's socially determined. In other words, we begin with a subject of desire, which is impersonal before it is individualized. So we don't begin with a classical notion of a subject who chooses, which is the way that morally that we cordon off and create exclusions around certain activities like drugs, alcohol, and so forth. But simply by medicalizing the discourse and saying that it actually has to do with gene deficiency or with brain, with brain states or with chemicals in the brain or something like that, simply poses the question of the subject further back, which we're not trying to do. I think that everybody's riding a kind of horse that Freud called it the death drive in a certain way, and in a certain way it's the question of what horse you find yourself on. We're all destroying ourselves in some way. We're all killing ourselves in some way. The belief in the idea of a normal individual is the absolute fantasy, like the belief in the idea of the normal sexuality in which perverts and masochists are, in a sense, ringing around the sides. If you think about it, heterosexuality is the biggest perversion, is full of the most perverts of any sexuality. I mean, you go and you look at any pornographic magazine, and you'll see every possible kind of perversion has been invented by the heterosexual institution. Okay, so what we're talking about as perversion is not that. Okay, so that's how I would respond to that. Yeah, I think that the reference that you're making actually was in a part of a text where we were critiquing the use of the concept of the model in the fashion industry, but it was derived from Plato, the notion of the idea. You know, for instance, the idea of the bed. You know, if you in a certain way how that forms. I mean, it's not by accident then that we're saying that the notion of the model is not simply neutral to the discourse of fashion. In a sense, it's a certain Platonic essence of how it reproduces identity or fixity or stabilization, including the stabilization of bodies. You know, for instance, the model's body. I always think that the model is, of course, the ideal body of the model is simply the ideal body to hang clothes on. Okay? In fact, most designers hate models, right? Because models get in the way of, you know, in a sense, the identity of the designer. So they want to, you know, kill the model by reducing them to the anorexic body. So there's a real sadistic sort of play, you know, in relationship between model and designer, model and creator, that is very Platonic at some level. We haven't really developed the idea any more than just beginning to think about even that these terms are not simply innocent. Thank you for your question, though.
There was no
No, the anus, I think I've got one too. No, I mean, it's precisely... Yeah. No, I mean...
No, I understand the anus is across the board, but it just seems lacking to be not talking about the penis in regards to fashion. And in the fashion industry, we look at women so much more on the cover, at least.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if that was a conscious choice, or that's just the way that you... I don't know.
I mean, what sense would it make in terms of gender equality and our critique of a certain construction of the body, you know, particularly in fashion, which usually you're right. It's usually, it's not a question even, I mean, first of all, I don't think that either of us are interested in penises and, you know, in the sense to talk about them. But in relation to fashion, it doesn't really seem to function, right, according to the same logic, which is why anus and vagina, one or the other, you know, in terms of how fashion constructs a relation of equivalence between the two at some level, and how, I mean, in a certain sense, I think to treat the logic of the penis or the phallus, let's say, it's certainly operating, but it's always positioned in the relation to the gaze in some way, and we didn't treat, it's in some ways trying to make choices not to treat it in the way that fashion's been read, I guess.
Yeah. Right, the other thing is that we actually introduced the concept of the anorexic. Now, the anorexic is, as we said, the process of becoming a woman, of either man or a woman. So that when we talk about the anorexic, we actually talk about that kind of impersonal catwalk of whoever. That is to say, we talk about a possibility of inventing a sexuality as a system of signs that would then work through the force of affects and not just pre-inscribed sexual positions or whatever, gender distinctions.
This is the strategy that we have too. I mean, when we're writing is in one. First of all, anytime you begin talking about the penis, I mean, all kinds of confusions emerge, right? It's too transcendental a signifier. It fixes gender too determinately. We're trying to move around identity, which is why we want to establish the equivalence of the orifices that are unisexual, so to speak.
Right.
You know, the anus is the vagina is the anus. I mean, there is a relation to the two. The second is that, of course, psychoanalysis talks a lot about the penis, and we're not doing psychoanalysis.
Everybody talks about penis. It's interesting. We spent kind of 20 or 30 years trying to get rid of that signifier, but everybody actually notices
if you don't talk about it, then it gets reintroduced. Yeah.
What about penis?
I don't know. I just, there's something nice about, you know, vaginas are lovely, my anus is, you know, tropical flower or something like that.
I have a question
that
was along the lines of the very first one that was asked. It's an inspiring scholar to live. I have an ongoing problem when I'm reading like the Russian Sands and especially the Thousand Plateaus with their use of, to what degree they're being literal. When they're talking about schizophrenia and their concept of becoming woman, and especially about anorexia, I find like the discussion of surface and depth and sort of anorexia and not anorexia to be really compelling, but I have trouble. I'm always struggling with it seems like.
Is it a metaphor?
Yeah.
Right. And their metaphors and how they're trying to enact this like reversal of Platonism, and they're trying to sort of like everything that Deleuze and Guattari are talking about is on the level of the real, and they're maybe trying to not to get away from representation, or to not use metaphors so much, and yet it seems like anorexia and schizophrenia are, I mean, you know, some of us here, maybe, you know, we have been in the hospital for anorexia, or maybe we've been schizophrenic for like the pleasures of like the specific physical pleasures of masochism. But it seems like they're using these very specific physical and emotional things we experience as these concepts that I seem almost platonic in a way. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but it's just a story.
Right, I think I know what you, what you want to say. Well, let me first remind you that schizophrenia is not the same as schizo. That is to say, they make a fundamental difference between what they call the clinical entity of schizophrenia and the term, the concept they introduced as the schizo.
Which is always, I mean, the examples are all from literature, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And they're used of Artaud, like, and I've seen that.
Yeah.
Right. So,
but then they use like Artaud's writing so explicitly to base their arguments on about that split that they're talking
right. Well, the other thing that I think you're after, correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, it kind of sounds nice, it's almost sexy, like to say body without organs, but what does it mean? I mean, who has a body without organs? So what actually my understanding is that what they're trying to do is not to tell you, look, And literally, the success of that experiment to get a body without organs would be an absolute failure. That's death. That's their definition of death. That's where the concept of micropolitics or experimentation comes into the whole game. That the idea is not to become Artaud, right? The idea is not to actually end up in a hospital.
But to escape.
Right? To escape both things. Yeah. That is to say, that's why we use the concept of micropolitics for what they actually use, the concept of experimentation. And that can fail. When it fails, you're dead, or you're in a hospital, or, you know, you're not in a good shape, right?
Yeah.
But the illusion is that by escaping simply death, that we are all in a good shape, which we are not. I mean, we are all in a terrible shape.
We just
right.
define as neurotic, then. You know, we're normal. Okay.
Like the Freudian.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what they're trying to do. They're posing that, you know.
And they keep saying there is nothing more difficult than to persist in successful experimentation. That's why they call it an ascetic project. It's
right.
terrible. It's really a serious kind of self-disciplining in losing oneself.
And it's
but
very dangerous. They always talk
dangerous.
About if you read, for instance, in the dialogues with Claire Parnay, as well as some of the early texts that have now been translated, they're always saying that any kind of ascetic process, any kind of resistance, you know, any way of trying to resist by shaping your body differently, trying to resist by doing something, by creating an ascetic project, always has its dangers and produces its own dangers, what they call the black hole, right? And the schizophrenic, the clinical schizophrenic, they would say would be an example of a black hole phenomenon that occurs in a schizoid movement to some degree. You know, those that failure is on either end, right? To become a successful neurotic or a failed psychotic, I guess. I mean, those are your two choices in life. So, in a sense, to try to find something in the middle, you know, I think is in a sense they're posing that.
But if I can say something, one little problem I would have with this model is that, thinking back to the schizo and Weaver's son, who is after all anorexic as well,
right.
since his problem begins when he has to translate the words of the foodstuffs.
Yeah.
That his mother brings him, and without a translation he cannot eat, and he cannot hear the voice, which is of course unbearable. I wonder whether there can be a way of taking leave or escaping without being caught up by the death drive. Like, in a way, what you're suggesting would be somebody would be halfway between Kafka's Hunger Künstler, who dies in the end, because he cannot find anything that fits his taste,
mm-hmm.
or then the anorectic top model as a revolutionary subject. And there, I wonder whether I'm ready to follow you there, or is it...
Well, I can tell you, you're never going to be the anorectic top model.
No.
No,
not my ambition.
That micropolitics has been deprived from you. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if posing those alternatives in that way, you know, in a sense, it is in a sense, I think that this is where maybe Branca could talk again. It's the question of the impersonal, and not of the way that every movement or every type is subjectified already and offered as in a sense. Why is it that the schizophrenic or the clinical depressed subject or the psychotic emerges, you know, socially to offer, in a sense, to all of us, you know, a warning sign, but also a vivid image of, in a sense, don't go too far, you know, in a certain way, as well as why is it that the perfect model is also got the eating problems? I mean, it's very interesting to, it's also, I mean, we don't have problems that it's bad, you know, I mean, in the sense that what isn't, I mean, at a certain level, it is, we're trying to develop a way of analyzing things without, in a sense, immediately reverting to moral categories in order to understand ultimately how to determine them socially. I mean, right. We think that, like I said, I mean, when you're eating food, you're eating death. When you're eating, you're just not conscious of that the meatpacking plant is, you know, has put a bullet through, you know, through the cow's head, you know, or the veal has been locked up in a box, you know, all of its life and fed milk, you know, or something like that. And it's not that sad sort of Marxist sort of consciousness raising either. It is, in a sense, an acceptance of the premise of violence as imminence. Maybe this is the reason there's a some sort of contingency between Nietzsche's show and our talk in some way. That's a way to think about the relationship. But you know, Aaron is the brilliant curator, so he's the one who already foresaw this.
Right. I guess that's where one can clearly see how close Deleuze and Guattari were to Foucault, and how their theory of Deleuze's theory of desire comes close to Foucault's theory of pleasure on a level of micropolitics. But to say that they experimented with the concept of micropolitics, and my understanding is that they actually excluded even the possibility of death drive, which is why they kind of tried to readdress both the masochism and anorexia, because for them there's no such thing as death drive. On the molar, the very fact that they actually started working with the idea of the micropolitics points to their different understanding of the way the power works. That is to say, which is not to say that they denied molar divisions between, say, classes, nations, cultural identities, or whatever, but There is a point at which Deleuze said to Foucault, what do you think about all those identity politics in marginal groups? And Foucault said, you know what, I'm sick and tired of being a marginal and that whole talk about marginal, but I will never become molar. So in a sense, by developing the concept of micropolitics, What I think they tried to do was something like this. Instead of waiting for a global revolution, let's try to restructure or disseminate, as it were, or confuse the molar field of power by experimenting with micropolitics. And they talk a lot about that in actually Anti-Oedipus in the second part, which is the part that usually people skip because it's not about sex and bodies without organs, where they actually talk about Russian Revolution. They say how the question is, how come everything started well and from the very beginning everything went wrong? So that idea of doing well and going in the wrong direction, nevertheless, is something that is constantly present in their addressing of molar politics. However, by analyzing the molar politics, say, of Russian Revolution, they at the same time analyze the phenomenon of cute as they put it, Russian girls in fur coats who would walk into a Russian Duma or parliament having a bomb in a fur coat, and then just activated a bomb and produced a huge body without organs, and including their own body, right, which is death, as I said. But they talked there about the revolutionary, a possibility of a revolutionary micropolitics becoming actually the moment of a molar revolutionary politics. So that would be, I guess, one way of answering that question.
Yeah, one more. There are two hands back here. There was one. Too small for the last question? No, we're talking about micro politics here.
Two questions, just a follow-up and an observation.
Okay. Oh, we don't want any observations, just questions.
I think mine's too small too, but I'm just trying to take seriously the idea that we're talking in non-metaphors, and I'm just trying. So the two first examples that popped into my mind are the one that we've been using, the runway model. The successful anorexic runway model who has a sort of neurotic micropolitical experiment, and the spiritual quest, the other micropolitical experiment of the sadhu, say, in India, who, and they have, you know, these similar, you know, physical, literal things that they do to their body. I mean, is it fair to make this sort of comparison?
I think that the Indian comparison was yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm asking.
Oh.
If one can make such a comparison.
Could you?
Oh, you mean in terms of the practice, the ascetic practices on the body?
Yes.
Well, in some ways, I mean, it's a very interesting question in the sense that you would begin to examine how, for instance, religious ritual, you know, that masochism, in a sense, actually exists, and you know, within different cultures and societies at the ritual level of the body. It's always inscribed in ritual. And then seeing how that gets decoded in some ways and inscribed in different ways or different rituals, different habits, social habits. I think it could be a fair comparison, but it would really have to be analytically constructed before you would really understand the spheres, you know, that you're trying to derive or compare at that point. But in a sense, the way that the body is changed, manipulated, practices, technologies or ritual practices of the body, shapes the body, that's interesting in the sense of that it is ascetic. The origin of the word ascetic has a very archaic religious origin to it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.